The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 171 for October 6th, 2008. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the show. I'm Dave Hamilton. I'm here with John Braun and Pilot Pete sitting in on this one, too. Hi, John. Hi, Pete.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi. So we have a backlog of questions, John. It seems like the volume of questions that comes in has been increasing steadily over the last couple of weeks. But that's good because it gives us a lot to choose from. Of course, we can't always get to everything, but we try.
That makes us sad.
That part does make us sad. You know, we could do a second show some weeks, John. I know we've talked about this.
We could and we will.
Really?
Talk.
We will talk. Oh, yeah. Great. Thanks, John. Nicely done. Okay. So we have some follow-ups to really kind of cap off the discussion on media longevity that we'll talk about at the end here. As well as revisiting some of the shutdown problems that we talked about in last show. John, you prepped some great stuff about a couple of the IAP issues. And the first thing we're going to talk about is Wi-Fi troubleshooting because some of you are having some problems and we'll see if we can't get this rolling. And I'm looking for Joe here, John. That's why I'm trying to buy time. Oh, I see what I did. I see it. See how I did that? Joe says, since I changed from my Linksys router to my BT home hub and also changed the location of the router from the old office upstairs to the new office downstairs, our connection has progressively slowed down to the point that my download speed is 130 kilobits per second and my upload speed is 330. Surely the download speed shouldn't be slower than upload speed. I know this isn't related to the distance from the exchange geographically, as I used to get good speeds of about 1.5 to 2 megabits. I'm wirelessly connected to the router, and I did the speed test on speedtest.net when I was next to the router. Any ideas what could have happened, and how can I fix it? John?
Where I'll start here, so number one, and a lot of longtime listeners know this, but we'll restate it because I think it's important. Whenever you approach a problem, you try to not change too many variables at once. And what concerns me here is that two things have changed. One is location. Another is the device. Okay.
Right. Yeah. So we haven't honored the troubleshooting process, if you will, because we've changed too many variables.
But in this case, I would guess or suggest an approach. So the device could certainly be the problem. And although this is being experienced wirelessly, which that suggests one course of action, but the immediate one that I would do is try to hook up perhaps in a wired fashion and see if you see the same slowdown. If you don't, then you can conclude perhaps that the wireless protocol is the thing causing the problem. So just one facet of how to, you know, figure that sort of thing out. Yeah. Could be that, you know, as we talk, well, wireless, I'll mention that too. Pete suggests this as well, is the firmware. Maybe it's old, you know, especially 802.11n, there's been some draft versions, maybe you got an old one. See if they can flash your device or upgrade it to the latest standard. Though I thought that one's pretty much finalized, but I guess there could be some draft versions. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, and the other thing is using something like speed test to check, and I lump all of the online test services together here, using something like that online to test doesn't really give you again, it's that whole troubleshooting process. There's too many variables out there. You're not just testing your wireless connection. You're testing your internet connection simultaneously.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a tool that I use now. It's sort of a geeky tool because you have to use it from the command line. And maybe there is a GUI version or a complementary GUI tool to this. But the tool I use is called iPerf, I-P-E-R-F as in Frank. And you run it from the command line. And all it does is send data back and forth. So you run it on two machines. You run it on one, you use the dash S option to put it in server mode. And then on the other machine, you use the dash C option. You say, I'm a client. And then you give it the IP address of the computer you're going to connect to. So it, you know, it's a test only of your local network, assuming you have two machines.
And what port
It'll work. You don't need to specify a port. It'll
okay.
It
so
uses
something common
port.
Or yeah, okay.
Well, I mean, it's you're running the same piece of software on both sides, so presumably it has a port that it uses, and that's
okay
that.
On a local network. Yeah,
it's cool. Just all local, right? Yeah, you're not going to the outside world. So that always allows me, like when I want to test gigabit between the house and the office here or whatever, that's what I use, and it's very reliable. Mm. So, you know, but it sounds like Joe's internet connection is not going to be as slow as what he's seeing with his download speeds here. Yes. Yeah, so there's something wrong. I like your idea of plugging in wired because that, you know, that'll at least rule out that the internet connection's the issue.
Yeah. And the only thing I'd observe is with a lot of these test sites, if you pick one that's close to you, if you know what's close to you, that's probably you get the best results. Maybe kind of obvious, but you know, like I pick New York City, you probably pick Boston as, you know, the nearest big pipe that, you know, you won't be crawling.
Actually, I think Speed Test usually selects Portland, Maine for me.
Really? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but Speed Test, you know, Speed Test can't go as fast as our connections can go.
Oh, of course not.
It tends to max out about 13 or 14, whereas I know my connection goes up to 18, at least when I'm in those initial bursts. So anyway.
So some things to try, but, you know, it may sound silly, but you may actually want to get, and I've done this, I think you've done this, Dave, you get a chart, you get yes and no columns for each variable, and you try them out and you figure it out.
Yep.
It's annoying at first because it's, you know, you got to get a piece of graph paper, draw pictures or something, but it works, you know, just eliminate all the options.
Yeah.
As long as you don't have too many, then it gets to be a pain.
Right. Yeah. But slowing it down from N to G, I think that's another, you know, a good test. See if it gets slower, see if it gets faster. You know, these are the things you got to check out, or try the old router. If you still have that, and try the old router in the new location and see if it's the router that's causing.
Yeah. With this device, the only thing I noticed is that it's only 100 device, you know, instead of a gigabit device. So, but I don't think that's the bottleneck.
No. And most of the Linksys routers are 100 megabit as well.
Mm hmm.
Because nobody's got an internet connection that's going to go gig.
Yet.
Right. That's right. That's right. All right.
Okay.
Well, while we're speaking of these Wi-Fi issues, Robert called in, and then I had a brief email exchange with him. So we'll share kind of both sides of this.
Hey, it's Desperate Robert. I've been working on this thing for probably about 3 hours now tonight. And I tried swapping out the Extreme card. And that had no effect. One thing I did do is I created a little network from my iBook. And the iBook connects to the G5, lickety-split, no problem whatsoever. If I go in and connect as I see the files, and it sees everything fine. But when I try the opposite and connect from the G5 to the iBook, okay, so this is totally has nothing to do with my network because my network's, you know, I'm not accessing the network from downstairs. It takes forever. I'm sitting here and I'm watching the scroll wheel, and you know, it's like while I was waiting for the scroll wheel for the G5 to connect, I clicked on the iBook and 1, 2, 3, I see the folders that I need to see from the other side, and now it just told me that. It's not showing me anything. When I hit connect as, it says connection failed. So it has something to do with what I'm able to receive on this G5. I don't know if there's any preferences that I can kill or not. But.
Yeah, and we went kind of round and round with a lot of the same suggestions that John and I just talked about. And then I got an email from Robert, and I'll spare everyone the colorful language and just get to the point. It turns out my neighbors changed the frequency channel they were broadcasting on their wireless network. I used Mac Stumbler or iStumbler to figure that out. Once I switched my router to channel 11, my speed was amazing. Moreover, my range was also increased to the point where my G5 now has 5 full bars. So again, you know, Robert was being very diligent, I mean, to the point where he was swapping out cards, truly trying to honor the troubleshooting process. And of course, with a wireless network, there are factors outside of your control. And that clearly is one of them. So,
yep. Yeah, I did one recently. I actually did a little piece, we'll link to it, but something called Air Radar, which I think is a little friendlier, but it shows a lot of things like channels and signal noise, things like that for all the base stations around you. So if you get a tool like this, or iStumbler, of course, is very good. Yeah, you can look for these, you know, ongoing interference issues where as people move in or switch around. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So, we've said it many times, by default, wireless routers all sit on channel 6. So knowing what your neighbors are using and moving away from that, and even preemptively, you know, Robert said he moved to 11. I'm assuming he might have moved from 6 to 11. I always just get off 6, even if I don't see any other networks around me, because that way I don't suddenly have some day where, my neighbor sets up a router and puts it in default mode and now suddenly nothing works. Yep. So,
and actually I'm looking at the snapshot, just, you know, kind of in a random small neighborhood, and I see 4 on 6, a couple on 1, 1 on 11. Mm. So, yeah, I think you got something there. Actually, I would look, the closest one to me with the highest signal strength, that's the channel I won't be on.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Very smart. Very smart. All right. And Tom has, to wrap up our Wi-Fi network part of the show, Tom asks, here's the problem. A neighbor has an open Wi-Fi network with the somewhat nefarious sounding SSID of Sinister. Occasionally, go figure. Occasionally, when my own airport network isn't detected right away, the Macs in my household will connect automatically to this seedy sounding open network. Normally, I pay attention to the network my Macs join, but I'm not so sure that other users on my network would notice it happening. So, what can I do to prevent my Macs from attempting to automatically connect to this neighbor's or any other open network? I'm familiar with the preferred network setting, but what I'm looking for is something like a banned network setting. There are obvious security risks to connecting to an open network. I don't want any of my network traffic to be available for sniffing by someone else. Yeah, I don't blame you, Tom, especially a guy who named his network Sinister. So, John, what you got? I know you got some thoughts here. So,
a couple of thoughts. So where I would look would be if you go into System Preferences, Network. You're going to have airport, and there's a little box there, ask to join new networks. If you click on airport, I would say yes. So this automatic thing does not happen. But then it says no networks will be joined automatically. So the next thing you want to do is if you click on advanced, there's an airport tab. Under that is preferred networks. These are the networks that your Mac has seen and trusts and will, unless you tell it otherwise, will automatically log into. You want to get rid of all of those. Yes, this is a pain in the neck. We are balancing security versus usability. But, and then the other thing is there's a box saying, remember any network computer is joined. I would uncheck that so it doesn't remember if you stumble across something else. So what I'm suggesting is a certain combination of wireless settings, which I think will avoid you automatically hopping on a network without it asking you about it. And even if you do, it, you know, won't remember it. So yeah. I think that is the best within the confines of the Apple software that you can do to avoid this.
Yeah, I don't know of a way of saying join everything but this network. I don't think there's a banned network list, or at least there's not in the UI. Maybe there's a command line way of doing it. If anybody out there knows, obviously, let us know and we'll filter the information along or funnel the information along. We'll run it through a sieve. How's that sound, John? No?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm trying.
What type of sieve?
Okay. Our first sponsor for this show is Smile on My Mac. Of course, they've been a sponsor of the show for a long time and recently released PDF Pen 4. PDF Pen being a piece of software that allows you to manipulate PDFs and create PDFs in a lot of different ways. Version 4 now adds the ability internal to the software for it to OCR, optical character recognition, meaning if you put a TIFF file in that's got text, it will offer to scan that text inside the software and convert it into editable text. Also now imports Microsoft Word documents directly. And if with PDF Pen Pro, you can create and edit table of contents. So they've added all kinds of stuff here. SmileOnMyMac.com PDF Pen is $49.95 and PDF Pen Pro is $99.95. And just now, this week, I think version 4.0.1 came out, and there's a preference now for OCR prompting. So for those of you that updated to version 4 and it was prompting you to scan for scan a document with OCR every time you opened it, you can turn that off and only scan when you want to. So they released version 4 on September 18th, and on October 1st, they had already listened to users' comments and made an adjustment, and I think there's some bug fixes or some other minor tweaks in there with 4.0.12. PDF Pen Pro and PDF Pen version 4.0.1 from SmileOnMyMac.com. And with this, John, we move on to Matthew, who writes, I must impose upon your time and ask a question. Occasionally, when using Safari to view secure websites, Safari will throw up the following message or something reasonably similar saying Safari can't open the page www.server.com because it couldn't establish a secure connection to the server www.server.com. Now, once this happens, attempting to open the same page in another browser causes the same problem with a slightly different message. In addition, resetting Safari completely or repairing the keychain produces no positive results. I know of but one solution, and that is to log into an administrative account, open Safari, close Safari, log out, then log back into the non-administrative account. This surprisingly will allow Safari to once again access secure sites for the time being. Have you come across this? Do you know of a permanent fix? I would greatly appreciate it if you have a solution because I access many secure sites during the week and can't afford to be without these sites. Using 10.5.5 on a G5 iMac. All right. I know you did some research on this, John, so why don't you kick it off and we'll go from
there. Yeah, a little bit, though. It sounds like a mess.
Yes.
I'll say first off, because I've never run into this. But it would have to do with certificates. Certificates are things that your computer knows about, servers know about, and if they match up, then you have a secure connection and your data is protected. Unfortunately, there are various little things that can make these certificates not work. And if they don't work right, or they're old, or they're corrupted, or whatever, or they don't trust another one, then you get these error messages. So probably the best place to look is keychain access. And I would suggest keychain access. Under the keychains, there's system roots. There's a whole bunch of these that you can look at. And you should make sure when you look at them that none of them seem to be expired or busted or whatever. You know, you'll see an expiration date and some other things because there have been cases where they expire. The other case is that you may not, so there's a list of these guys that the browser people trust it may not be included, so your browser may not know about a certain certificate, we'll just call it that, and you have to get one and say, yes, I trust this, and then your browser will stop complaining. I'm suspecting that may be part of this problem, is that it's somebody using a certificate that's not known to the browser, and the best way it can tell you there's a problem, which is totally incomprehensible, is what was described. So that'd be my suggestion. And Apple does have articles telling you how to import new certificates if you need to do so, which I think is what's happening in this case. And I don't know your thoughts, Dave.
Well, one thing that I noticed as I was rereading his question for our listeners here, John, is that he said when he logs into an administrator account, it seems to work fine. And then logging back into his other account. So I have to assume he's got a non-administrator account that he's using for the lion's share of what he does. Once the keychain or the certificate has been opened, then he's able to do it. So it makes me think that, all this stuff is stored in the system keychain, I believe.
I think I see where you're going. I think there may be different keychains involved here, or?
Well, no, they should. All the certificates should be stored in the system keychain, which should be open for all users. Now, what it sounds like, though, is that portion of it is locked out until an administrator opens it up, and then it's open for all the other users on the machine. That's not how it's supposed to work, folks, but it seems like that might be happening here. I'd be curious to see if creating a new user account, not administrator privileges, just a regular user account, there might be something wrong with the permissions or the security settings for Andrew's, I think it was Andrew, right? No, sorry, Andrew's the next one, Matthew's account.
Matthew.
Yeah. And I, you know, I wonder if that, I wonder if that's the issue, you know, that, cause it just seems strange that opening it with an administrator, you know, obviously it's blazing a path somewhere and, I don't know, just something doesn't seem quite right. So, and then there's also the OCSP and CRL. Did you tell them about that, John? You have that,
Yeah, we have it here. So, okay. You know, keychain access certificates under preferences. Certificates. There will be. These are two protocols. Say, hey, is this certificate valid? Unfortunately, they're not always supported properly. So when it tries to check that, it just kind of gives up.
Yep.
Or locks up.
Yeah, I had an issue with certificates on my machine, and I don't know how, but OCSP got turned on. The online certificate status protocol was going out and trying to verify these certificates. So going into, like John said, keychain access preferences and then the certificates tab and turning both of those off solved all my problems. So
it's less secure, but as I think we mentioned, security versus usability. If you can't do what you need to do.
Yeah. So Matthew, try that with another user account and report back to us, because this sounds very curious. It should not work that way. And I'm wondering if you've got an issue there.
Yeah, all right. One other thing I saw. Go. Did you mention the cookie thing here?
No, I.
Well,
I
found one posting
suggesting
every now and then a cookie misconfigured or not accepted may cause this. But
really, I thought cookies and certificates
they're totally separate. Yeah, right. but yeah, I'll find the post. I found an offbeat post that suggested, hey, I changed this cookie preference, and all of a sudden something started to work again. So,
All right. Well,
we'll link to it.
Yeah. Stranger things have happened. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Andrew writes, I recently started having a weird issue with iTunes. Occasionally, an error pops up saying the iTunes library file cannot be saved. An unknown error occurred. And then in parentheses, 13011. I'm not really sure what that means, but it seems not good to me. I poked around online and found a discussion thread on Apple's discussions, which was less than helpful. Just wondering if you have any suggestions, as unlike the poster in the forums, I don't have an older copy of my iTunes library to replace it with. So, John, you found some stuff out about how to manage iTunes libraries, I think, here.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a, nuke and pave, as you've put it in the past, but... I don't know. I mean, there are instructions how to recreate your iTunes library, which I saw in some discussions is kind of a way to try to address this. It's extreme, but it requires you to get rid of certain files that contain directories, and we have the detailed instructions from Apple. But usually, that's the last thing at the end of the chain. I don't know what you have to suggest.
Yeah. So there is. Repairing the library, I think, is really it. It sounds like the library is damaged. What you might do is quit iTunes and make a copy of the two files that sit in your home music iTunes folder, and they are iTunes library and iTunes music library.xml. So making copies of those, if the file itself is damaged or stored on a damaged section of the disk, that might fix it, but chances are you got to just go and recreate that library. Unfortunately they don't offer any way to repair it. Okay. Pilot Pete's telling us about a tool called Sanuti.
Yeah. It's iTunes spelled backwards. Yeah. Which is, and there's a couple others out there that are good library managers that may help him at least do the export and import and continue to use iTunes. That's actually a good one to get if your music off of your iPod. For instance, my son had to reinstall on his MacBook, and he had all his music on his iPod. And he's like, oh, Dad, I lost all my music. I said, well, you haven't refreshed your iPod, have you? He's like, no. So we'll go get Snooty. We'll pull your music back down and rebuild your library that way.
Huh.
So.
Very cool. That's good to know. I like this. Cool. Okay. Well, maybe you can try Snooty. It doesn't sound like it repairs the library. It just sounds like it rebuilds it for you.
It helps you manage it.
Got it.
Get it out.
So you can see it.
Yeah.
Got it. Got it.
That's a big stumbling block I always noticed.
Yeah.
Being able to see what you're doing. Stuff.
All right. So last week we talked about a machine that wouldn't shut down. And we got some interesting comments about this. Robert has one, and then we'll talk about some of the others that we got, because it gets curiouser and curiouser.
Hey, guys. This is Robert from New Jersey, and I'm calling in regards to the fella who had a phone call last week where his Mac was not shutting down unless he had to hold down the power button. My recommendation is Onyx. I would run Onyx, repair permissions, run daily scripts, optimize the complete system, and delete all cache files. Check them all. Get rid of it. And then restart and see what happens. I don't know if that'll solve the problem, but yeah.
Okay, so Onyx. I've certainly mentioned Onyx before. It's one of my favorite go-to utilities and is a perfect way of doing that. I always feel like when I'm deleting virtual memory cache files, though, I feel a lot better about doing that. And I feel like it happens in a much cleaner way when I'm doing it in single user mode and those files aren't active. When you're doing that sort of thing with Onyx, I just can't believe that it can be effective enough, because it's trying to modify files that the system is inherently tied to. I mean, it is like, you know, integrated with those files. So I can't imagine that Onyx deletes virtual memory cache files properly or as well as you would doing it from the command line where, you know, they're not in use.
Yeah, I leave the OS to deal with that.
Well, but he's having a problem, so we got to get past the OS. We can't. Right. The OS didn't. The OS has failed him.
Failed,
or perhaps it hasn't. And that's where the content of the rest of we got. You know, when I saw the first email suggesting what we're going to talk about here, I thought, it's a wild card, right? Yeah, right. And then when there were like,
I saw that too.
To 10 more along the same lines. It was like, we got to talk about this. And what it is, it's possible. All these people independently suggested that this behavior where a machine gets to the all the windows go away and the only thing that happens is that spinning gear. When it gets to that point, if it sticks and does not reboot, it's an indicator that the hard drive is dying. And like I said, we had, you know, many of you email in with this as the lone symptom you all saw just before the drive took a nosedive and never came back.
So it's either a trend or the only outlet for people that are bitter that their hard drives have rolled over and died.
I guess that's possible. It would be odd, though, if we had a significant cross section of our listeners that was very upset about this and looking for a way of just coming out and
just came to me. No, I apologize.
Of course, it's possible, John. We always appreciate those sorts.
But they
of
have
thoughts.
No. And actually, we saw this in the well, I think we mentioned it. We'll mention it again. But the chaining thing, where we had a past problem. Which involved chaining drives, and I think they were Western Digital. And apparently someone pointed out they had a couple that didn't work right, and it's always possible. Mm-hmm. So you get a run of something that just.
You know, there was an interesting thing, and now I'm going totally off the cuff on this here.
Yep, go, brother.
When we talked about a listener who had three external Western Digital drives and was having trouble getting one to connect, we got some emails after the fact that said, okay, look, you know, a lot of times these hard drive manufacturers that are making these cases will put the same ID on all of the chips in the case. So when you string too many of them together, sometimes the OS doesn't know which one it's reaching out and trying to touch. And using different brand cases can be a you know, a solution to that problem. That's pretty far-fetched, or it's pretty out there in that I haven't seen a whole lot of that, but it's certainly possible. So so I throw it out there as advice from one listener to all of the others. So,
but honestly, I would think a shutdown does involve some level of drive activity. So,
of course,
who knows? Could be the power surge or the you know, extended, you know, duration of trying to do something which the drive is saying help.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, interesting. All right, our second sponsor for this show is Circus Ponies, and of course, they've been a sponsor for a little while here, and just released. On September 22nd, Notebook 3.0. Now, Notebook is an application that allows you to organize things into different notebooks. And so you can keep projects separated out. Inside the notebooks, you can have text, you can have pictures, you can have PDFs. The new version adds sketching support, so that you can draw right inside the application. If you've got something that you've just got in your head and you've got to get out quick, you just draw it and it's right there. You can also use its new diagramming tools to actually create, you know, flow charts and things that look like that. Sticky notes now can be pasted inside or on top of documents inside your notebook. They can hold text. They can hold diagrams. You can even do handwritten text. So you can use the sketching for that. We had one listener right in, and Jeremy says, the thing about Circus Ponies Notebook for me is the indexes. Check them out. They sort and filter in ways that allow you to produce lists and to-dos and all kinds of goodies from the data you already input. For me, the indexes, in 3.0, they call them multi-dex, are what sets this great app apart. So definitely check that out, and thanks, Jeremy. This is at circusponies.com. It's Notebook 3.0. The Notebook pricing is $49.95, and if you want a three-user family pack, you can actually get a three for the price of two at $99.95. So that's Notebook 3.0 from Circus Ponies at circusponies.com, and we appreciate them being a sponsor, too.
Indeed.
Do you have something to add there, John? I heard you chiming in, warming up, revving up.
No chiming.
Well, then we move on to the CD and DVD discussion that we've had. We've been talking about the length of time that a CD or the data on a CD or the data that you've burned to a DVD will last, and I think what we've got here will really kind of tie this up. So we'll let Dave go first, right? Not me, Dave, but listener Dave. Yeah, sounds good.
Hey guys, this is Dave from Pennsylvania, and I have a question about show number 170. Where you said about recordable CDs and DVDs and the longevity of them. I actually have CDs from 1995, and I probably had about 50 or 60 of them. And they're all still good, and they read just fine. I did find a few of them with what looked like to me to be like, the only thing I can describe it as a CD rot, where the actual data layer looked like it was eaten away, and have no explanation for why. That was only a few of them, though. So out of a lot of them, most of them are good. And also, I have a pack of CDRs that I bought way back, like 1996, I'd say, that I've had since then, and I can still write to them.
Wow.
So I don't know if that means anything to you guys or not, so, but I just want to let you know, this is where you cut me off.
It is. And you have been cut off. Thank you, though, Dave.
Cut him off. Dude, this is like Super Dave. I'm sorry.
I don't know
what he's doing
Osborne,
get these amazing longevity numbers, but actually, I'd be curious what media, I mean, if the company's still in business, I think they'd love to meet you.
Yeah, that's right. That's probably true.
And actually, I've seen that phenomenon, though. And I think it's more when you use organic dyes or whatever versus metal, where you see it almost looks like it's moldy and stuff. And I think it actually is kind of, well, it's degrading in some fashion, but.
Right. Right. And you know, Mort writes in, and speaks to some more of this, and I'm just going to read what Mort wrote, because It's fantastic. So details of CD and DVD construction are that the recording media is on the clear plastic surface just under the label. Therefore, a felt tip pen is required to not destroy the label when writing on the label surface. If the recording media is silver or gold, then you can get 30 or more years of CD or DVD life. If the media is light blue or green, then it is likely to be a chemical layer good for 5 years or less. Now, this is counter to what we've seen in other places. Certainly metal lasts longer, but the 5 year number for blue or green, that's Mort's experience. And he's obviously been involved in these things for a long time. So this is interesting. Humans excrete acid from their skin during certain physical conditions. And it turns out even if you're wearing rubber gloves, the acid comes through. Therefore, the CD or DVD media should never get touched on the flat surface of the label, but only held by the edges. Interestingly, going back to our discussion about hard drives, John, Mort also writes, magnetic media is always seeing the Earth's magnetic field. If the media is not moved in a year, then the Earth will change the magnetic configuration on the media by trying to align all the north-south items. Therefore, you must operate that drive every 6 months or so to keep the data safe. In 1930, Geosource started collecting data on 10-inch reels of magnetic tape. In the 70s, they were continuing to protect their tapes by rewinding each tape annually and storing them in a temperature and humidity controlled space. To my knowledge, they never lost data.
So,
thank you, Mort. This is fantastic to hear, and interesting about the acid on the skin. It's good to know not to touch that.
Ooh. Well, yeah. That's why when you see initially people handling these very gingerly and you're like, what's wrong with them? Why are they doing this? That's why.
Yeah.
Because any sort of any contact with the you know, layer that takes the data is bad.
Yep. And you know, we also got an email from Stan who said his experiences and research showed that MAM-A brand, which used to be Mitsui Gold, has some secret coating that makes them last. It makes them much less prone to scratches. And he also said that permanent markers are bad and that you shouldn't write on the CD with a permanent marker. And I thought, well, yeah. And I emailed him back and said, OK, this is odd because what else? I mean, I don't want to use a ballpoint pen. What should I use? No. And he said the ink in, a Sharpie, if you will, can permeate that top layer. And if it does, of course, following Mort's description there, that's where the data is, right below the label. So, Stan said, if you want to write with a permanent marker and be certain you're safe, only write on the clear part of the disc where there's no media on the other side. So very interesting. Very, very interesting. Should we, and we should follow this up with, do we have anything else to say here, John, before we follow it up with Mark's question?
No, I like the whole, especially the hard drive thing where we touched on, and I think it's agreed, hard drives are probably the best, but you can't just let them sit on a shelf.
Right.
So I stand corrected because that was my impression.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, Stan said the same thing.
And I guess any media or anything, you know, fire up the hard drive once a year or whatever, just to make sure it doesn't, atrophy and never start up again.
Well, and it says both Stan and Mort, just to be clear, said do it every 6 months, because if you wait a full year, the drive will start to realign. Right. So 6 months minimum, which is interesting because I've got stacks of hard drives downstairs that I pulled out of old servers or whatever. And I'm guessing, as we talked about last week, I don't have the interfaces here to match up to those drives, so they're kind of useless. But I couldn't just throw them away because they had sensitive data on them. So, I guess I got to get out the sledgehammer some weekend.
Or, we saw at some shows, they have drive shredders.
Right.
If you're just into shredding up hard drives, somebody makes a machine that does it very well.
That's great. All right. Let's listen to Mark's question. I think it's, I put it in the group here, which means it must be related.
John and Dave, this is Mark. I love your show. I listen to it every week. Keep up the great work. I was listening to your most recent one, and you guys were talking about saving on to DVDs, CDs. And what's your take on what should I save as far as media, photos, movies, versus what do I need to put onto which form of disc, CD versus DVD? I know movies you got to put onto DVDs, but as far as backing up your photos, can you back up photos onto a DVD? And what is the pros versus cons of backing up onto a DVD with a photo media? And John and Dave, I follow both of you guys on Twitter, so you do have followers out there, which I'm sure you are aware of, and enjoy listening to your little conversations back and forth. So look forward to your response, and we'll look forward to your next podcast. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mark. Okay, so this is interesting, right, John? Because he says, you know, we have to store movies on DVDs, and where can pictures go? I'm going to take this a step back here and say data discs can store anything. So you could store your pictures on a CD. You could store your pictures on a DVD. You could store your pictures on a hard drive. And the same is true for movies as long as they fit. Now, if you want your DVD player, not your computer, but your DVD player to play a movie, then it has to be in the UDF format on a DVD in a very specific directory order with video TS and audio TS folders in the right places.
Right. But the toast or something will do that.
Yeah, it's easy enough to do, but you've got to follow a prescribed method. And that's because your DVD player only knows how to do one thing, or that, you know, certainly knows how to do that thing. It might have other capabilities as well. Mm-hmm. But you can store all your movies on a hard drive and in separate folders, and then point, if you want to play them, point DVD player to it or VLC, and it'll play your movies off a hard drive. It'll play your movies off a CD if the movie's small enough to fit on a 600 or 700 meg CD. So really your choice of where to store this stuff comes down to what's the right media for you now and in the future, and how much space do you need? You know, you could do a dual layer DVD and store all your pictures on it. It's probably not economical because two regular DVDs are going to be cheaper than a single dual layer, at least in my experience. So, you know, but you got to figure out what's most important to you and do it that way. But certainly you don't have to tie, in my experience, and my feeling is you don't have to tie any one type of media to any one type of yep. media.
And then
I'll use that word in two ways in the same sentence.
Okay. And then I'll appeal to the OCD crowd. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which I know there's one or two or,
there's 247 of them, John.
Oh, okay. No, but I was going to say, you want to think your strategy. What do you want to save long term? What's like forever, like for the next generation? What's medium term, and what's, you know, you take it once and you chuck it, and then try to think. Now, again, some people may not have the time to spend on thinking about this, but if you do, think about it. You know, what can you get rid of? Stuff you take on your iPhone? Well, who the heck knows? It depends what's important to you. But,
right.
Right. You know, set up your some stuff. Yeah, you could keep online. And Pete and others, you know, pointed this out. There's, you know, MobileMe and all these other, you know, Flickr and all these sorts of services where they're probably good short to medium term storage, but not long term. Because I think they typically ditch stuff after a certain amount of time, but they may offer plans to burn it for you. Who knows? I'm sure some of them do.
Yep. And a couple of people, Arun, wrote in, and of course, Pete, I know you have one, mentioned the Drobo. You know, so it's a easy to use, at home, idiot proof, plug and play RAID storage solution.
It's pure magic.
Right, well,
it's what it boils down
magic.
To. I mean,
nice.
The technology that goes into that thing has got to be worth 10 times what they're charging for it. So,
wow.
Free Drobo commercial here.
I think they're going to send you a bill.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. I mean, you got four disks, or you can put up to four disks in it. And yeah. I think they can, I think up to 16 terabytes on their new FireWire one. I've got a little over 1.5 in mine. It's array. A disk fails, hot swap it, pull it out, put a new one in.
No lost data.
No.
So it's striped. It's RAID 5 or whatever it is.
It's striped and mirrored and everything else. It's bizarre how and it's plug and play. I mean, it's USB or FireWire.
Yep.
You stick two SATA drives in to start, and if you only have money for 300 gig or 200 gig drive, you put those in, and as you need more data, put another drive in.
And it automatically on the fly reconfigures.
It reconfigures and stripes, and it's good to go. I started off with a 320 and a 500, and now I have a 320, a 500, a 750, and a 1 terabyte in that thing.
And forgive me for not knowing all the details of the product here. You can do USB or FireWire. You can't do a networked version of it yet, or can you?
Well, no. Mine's networked, but only because I have the AirPort Extreme in.
Got it.
On a USB.
Sure.
And so I don't have the FireWire version. But
even if you had FireWire, it wouldn't rocket network.
I don't know if there's a way to, you guys might know, you know better than me, if there's a way to network a FireWire one, maybe off of an iMac that's always on or something.
Well, what you'd have to do is hang it off of that,
But on the Mac itself, I think supports some level of RAID, so I guess the one thing it offers is that you can pop drives in and out easily, which of course you can't do.
And it's they've got a little video on there. It waters your eyes the first time you see it. He puts on a movie and plays the movie and then pulls one of the drives out, and the movie continues to play, and he puts another drive in. And I think some of it's time compressed because it does take a long time to put all your data, obviously, onto another drive.
Yeah.
But it's slick. I love my Drobo.
There it is. That's
and it loves you. I'm
pretty sure they didn't pay him to say that. Yeah. And I know you've dealt with their support too, and it's been great.
Actually, early on I had an issue, and one of their they don't guarantee this, but one of their engineers actually emailed me and said, "Did you get this worked out?" And what it was beautiful.
Wow.
Very, very strong support.
Wow. All right, we're 46 minutes into this little puppet show here, John. Do you want to talk about your email thing and then head out, or you want to save that for next week?
We could. I'm going to look into it a bit more.
You want to look into it a bit more. All right, that's fine.
You want me to go?
Go. Let's go.
Work hard.
All right. Seriously.
Either that or I can talk about hard drive space disappearing. You pick it.
Here we go. So here's my problem. I was I run something called Spamfire, which is basically I'll call it a mail proxy server. It's spam filtering. It talks to my email server. It talks to my mail program. It sits there and filters out junk. Well, for a little while, and I was tweeting to people about this, but it would sit there on my main ISP and just say, you know, filtering, filtering, filtering. I'm like, what the heck is going on? I thought it was a problem with company servers because they have an online service and stuff like that. But eventually I'm like, you know what? I'm going to look underneath the covers here. I'm going to lift the hood and look in the engine of my email and figure out what the heck's going on. So I telnet it directly to my ISP's POP server. And I'm like, you know, let me see what's going on here. So telnet into it. And it's actually RFC 1939. Request for comment, I guess. But that's for the POP or post office protocol. And so I decided to log in, run telnet from the command line, telnet to the server 110, enter username and password. And I'm like, all right, well, let me look at this. Let me type list. And when I type list, of course, then I see a few messages. And I'm like, well, that's really weird because the other utility is supposed to get rid of old messages. So apparently there was a mismatch between the utility that grabbed the mail and filtered it and my email server. So I'm like, well, you know what? I don't need the, because they were old messages too. So I got rid of all of them, logged off, logged back, ran the spam fire again, went right through them, no problem. So I thought it was a problem with their servers because they do reach out and collect spam info and offer it back in a real-time fashion versus the stored database. So, but boy, that was annoying that I had to dig underneath the covers. And yeah, there was some mismatch where I think, I'm thinking the utility had one idea of what the world looked like, but the server kept spitting back, well, I got these things. What do I do? And it's like, I don't know.
So here it is. I'm going to stand up on my soapbox because we've seen this lot over the years. Now, the POP, the post office protocol. So I think many of us are aware that when you set up your email, the client typically asks you a question that says, is your account a POP account, P-O-P, or IMAP? POP is Post Office Protocol. IMAP is Internet Mail Access Protocol. The POP protocol is really built to have messages come into the server, and they sit on the server until your client connects and then sucks all the messages off the server and deletes them. That is when POP works best. IMAP, on the other hand, is built, messages come into the server, they stay on the server, and all your mailboxes stay on the server. And then your mail client merely syncs up with what's on the server. Now, your mail client can make changes. You can move a message from your inbox to the trash or send a message out and file a copy of it in the sent box. And then when you connect with another mail client, it syncs up with the server and sees all those changes that have been made, including any new mail that's come in and that the server's delivered. The problem is when apps like Spamfire and even folks who are trying to manage their email and get it in three different places but are connecting to a POP server are trying to treat POP like IMAP and leaving stuff on the server and managing it that way. And it always gets to the point where it fails. And the reason is the server keeps all your messages and assigns IDs to them. And the clients rely on that. They say, OK, well, I've seen up through message 3415. So I know that I don't need to look at messages 1 through 3415. I just need to look at 3416 and in the future. And if the mail server, and this happens with POP servers often, if they make any changes to the POP server, it could renumerate all your mail. And now let's say you had 15 messages on your on the server. Your mail client says, well, I'm going to look for messages 3516 to 3530. And the mail server says, I have messages 1 through 15. So the server's Spamfire is going to say, well, I don't see message 3516, which means everything that's on the server is old and I've seen it before. It has no other way of knowing this because POP is not built to act this way. And it you know, so this is the problem. So IMAP would be a much better solution. Now, of course, many ISPs don't offer IMAP, and those that don't should be taken out and fricasseed, if you will. Yeah, at least they should have the CEOs of these companies should be forced to stand up in front of a crowd who is waving their fists in anger. That's that's what should happen. That's going to be the new punishment from the Geek Gab here.
Or publish their email username and password.
There you go. Publish there. That's right. But anyway, that's you must stand in front of a crowd of people shaking their fists in anger. And that will be the new punishment here. And so that's that. I know you use Opt Online and they don't offer IMAP. Comcast actually
not
does.
That I can tell.
Comcast does.
Yeah. And so you're gearing up for the political season, I think. With the shaking of the fist.
The shaking of the fist. Oh, yeah.
Pretty nasty.
Less than a month away, man. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And pretty brutal.
Well, you know how it goes. That's folks up here in New Hampshire. What do we call ourselves? Coastal liberal independent elitists or something like that? I think that's
something with rocks.
Huh? What's that?
Something with rocks.
I don't know about rocks. Granite State. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Who's that?
We're in the Granite State. That's what it's.
Is
called.
That you? That's what I thought. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's us. You're coming to the Granite State in November, I hear.
Granite headed. Yeah, I think I will be. Somehow. Yeah, I booked my flight for the show.
For Macworld?
Really big show. Yep. It's getting pricey.
It is.
Fly.
I know. It's crazy.
Fuel. Even though fuel's gone down.
No. Look. The airlines were living hand to mouth for a long time.
Yeah.
We had this oil, and I'm making air quotes, crisis. And all the airlines use that to raise their rates and add all these other fees. Now oil prices are going down. They leave the fees up. The good news is that the airlines are probably heading towards a point where they might actually be solvent. So that's a good thing. Are we?
What are you saying?
Are you ready to go here?
What?
Okay. So speaking of Macworld, that's January 5th through 9th. There are still some hotel rooms. I think it's down to a handful. of rooms available, especially for peak nights, which I think are Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So we've got a link in the show notes for you. You can, in fact, if you just Google Macworld hotel deal, we're the first link you get. So
nice.
Feel free to. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's good. iPhone Alley is Michael Johnston's site and podcast, and he converts this show to AAC for you. And let's see, CashFly provides all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace includes the A5 and A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, PDF Pen from Smile on My Mac, BB Edit from Barebone Software, and Notebook from Circus Ponies, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network.
Yep. I'm going to call you. How do I call you?
I know. You know, I even...
How do I call me?
I started writing down that we had to talk about contact info on
you.
Just not here. 206-666-GEEK. Which is, John?
4335.
That's right.
How else? Well,
email.
Yeah.
Feedback at MacGeekGab.com. We certainly read lots of email tonight.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Skype to MacGeekGab. You can send smoke signals, but I'm not so good at reading them.
I like the iTunes comments myself.
Yeah, we love the iTunes comments. I had to laugh. I'm saying smoke signals here. I look in the little Skype chat that we have going during the show, and there's Pilot Pete saying smoke signals. So we've got this mind meld happening here in the Durham studio. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what that means.
More beer.
Oh, boy.
Pete put a, I was going to say a nice picture. Pete put a picture of me during the pre-show up on nice. Twitter. Twitter. Yeah. You can find us on Twitter. We mentioned Twitter. Twitter.com/PilotPete. Twitter.com/John F. Braun. And right. Twitter.com/Dave Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. It's cool. I still like it.
It's fun. It's a nice way to keep in touch with everybody.
But at a slower pace, at a more relaxed pace. Mm-hmm. Happens when you're relaxed.
Well, if you get too relaxed, and when you think you're not, then you get caught. So don't get caught.
Made up.